Okay, could you state your full name first, please?
Yeah. William Alphonsus Riggio.
And your date and place of birth?
St. John de Brunswick, December 15, 1927.
Okay, could you give me a little bit of information on your educational background?
A grade school and high school at St. Vincent's Boys School in St. John de Brunswick. Undergraduate education at St. Francis Xavier University in Antigonish. Part-time student at Dalhousie University for 1 year. Graduate student at Laval University, Quebec City. Continuing at the University of Ottawa. So a PhD. And then postdoctoral education at Notre Dame University, South Bend, Indiana. And then another stint at postdoctoral work in the 60s at the College of Ceramics, New York State University at Alfred, New York. Part-time, or rather, short course at MIT.
And briefly, your research interests over the years? Describe them?
They've been pretty broad. Initially in the field of amino acids, which at the time were not nearly as prominent as they are now, although the professor I worked with told me they would be. In other words, in organic chemistry. After I got my degree, I moved away from organic chemistry and went back to something that I had an earlier interest in, analytical chemistry. And I worked in that area throughout my professional life in the lab. But I was very early in my career connected to the Nova Scotia Research Foundation, which was a multidisciplinary organization, and as such I got involved in a wide variety of research projects. Forestry, energy, coal, fuel cells, environmental studies over the years, water chemistry, quite a broad range of topics.
So you say you first came to St. Mary's in 1954?
I believe, yes. I think it was January 1954.
Mm-hmm. And what was the science department consisting of at that time?
Well, I think it was Professor Alan Sabian, Professor James Murphy, the Jesuit, and that was it in chemistry. Engineering at the time was considered a faculty. There was no faculty of science. And in engineering there were two professors, maybe three, including a part-time person. Biology, the Rojos, whom you probably have spoken to, were basically the biology department, Mr. and Mrs. Rojo. Physics seemed to be taught by, physics and mathematics were taught by the other professors, that is the chemistry professors and the engineering professors. They pitched in to teach physics. And the odd part-time professor in one aspect or another of science was hired, but it was very, very, very small cadre of people at that time.
What were the academic course offerings?
Well, the first courses that would fall into the first 2 years of a university program with chemistry was probably even then a little bit more advanced, and they did give degrees in science where the students studied for 4 years, and the few students that did go through that type of program would be given the upper level courses on almost on a one-to-one basis by Father Jimmy Murphy and by Professor Alan Sabine. And as I say, in my case, I was brought in on a part-time basis to do a second-year course and to introduce analytical chemistry. So it was a small operation.
So how did it develop, just briefly, how did the department develop over the years that you've been here?
Well, the numbers of students involved it's a small number. I don't know what the total registration of the university in those days was, but it was maybe between 200 and 300 for all faculties. And I think that higher education grew in the 50s and certainly in the 60s, and became great demand, certainly after Sputnik. There was a huge increase in the number of people who wanted to go to university, and so what was there was just built upon, and the class sizes increased dramatically. I started out in one course, four students, and that particular course only grew to about something in the low 20s, but the other course that I was dealing with, I think, had between 20 and 30. And the last year that I taught that course was, I think, something between 100 and 110, which is far, far too many students in a science course for my liking, anyway. So it grew partially as a result of the desire on the part of the population for higher education. St. Mary's was situated in a metropolitan community, so they had a bigger demand on them in that respect, more people here. Just a gradual development, and they tried to accommodate the growth by picking up part-time professors, you know, or professors to teach one course instead of that.
Were there particular programs or areas of study that were introduced during the years?
No, generally speaking, you got a Bachelor of Science degree. That was it. And there was, I suppose, an introduction of somewhere along the line during that period of the concept of an honors degree, but very, very few students who would have followed that. It was by and large a general degree, or you'd have to go back, I'd have to go back and look at the calendars and whatnot and see where the concept of the major degree came in, but I would tend to think that it was sometime in the late 50s, where they'd be talking about a major in chemistry and a major in physics. But prior to that, it was just like a Bachelor of Science degree. Mm-hmm. It was a very heavy requirement for arts subjects in those years, you know. The students had to do, I think, three courses in philosophy, three courses in English. And then these were the people that were taking science, you know. And mathematics was also required, but mathematicians were scarce, very scarce, even into the 60s. I can remember going to, I think it's the University of Waterloo, with the president to try and get a PhD for a professor of mathematics. Nobody in mathematics had a PhD. Most of the courses were taught on a part-time basis. And at the time, Dr. Stanton at the University of Waterloo had between 60 and 70 PhDs in the mathematics department. He really had a corner on all the mathematicians in the country. And he was very good about it. And he said, well, you can try and rate us if you like, you know. But that's just to give you an indication that even into the 60s, mathematicians were very, very hard. PhD mathematicians were very hard to get a hold of. Mm-hmm. So the big change in all of these things was around 1967 when Dr. Lavelle became president. And there was dramatic change at that time. In the short time that he was president, between 2 and 3, effectively 3 years, but the last part of the last 6 months, you know, he was coasting out. The growth was just dramatic, very dramatic, like nothing else. And Professor Smirnevich, there were only two full professors in the whole university, Father Burke Daphne and Dr. Smirnevich. The president didn't have them. They kept that title, full professor, on a very high plane. And Father Burke Daphne, I think, published something every year he was here for years and years and years. And Dr. Smirnevich was from Poland. He's a world figure in terms of World War II and so on. And he went to Harvard as a visiting professor at the time, and then he went to Notre Dame, or vice versa, but he was away for 2 years as a visiting professor at those two institutions. And when he came back, I met him over here, just at the entrance to the McNally building off the parking lot, and he said, what happened here? And I said, well, what do you mean? Well, he said, I left here 2 years ago. St. Mary's was a college. I come back here now, it's a university. Now that was a comment by one of the only two people who were operating internationally at the time. Mm-hmm. So then from that point on, it was a different type of growth. It peaked a bit, then dropped off, and then it began to rise again. And in the second rise, it's gone up to where it is now.
So, when you first started in the science faculty, there was not even a science building. How have the research facilities changed over the time you've been here?
Well, that all happened at the same time.
Around that time?
67. Now, as individuals, Father Jimmy Murphy was operating. He'll probably tell you this, it was nothing more than a closet over in that area as you enter from the parking lot into the McNally building. The entranceway, when you walk in those doors, that was my lab. That's where I had four students in this particular course that I was talking about. Turns out that one of those four, I think, is the most eminent graduate we've had in science in all the years I've been here. But so those of us who were doing things just did it under difficult conditions. People today don't know anything about that. They wouldn't appreciate it. I don't even want to hear the stories, mm-hmm. but I'm going to tell them.
Okay. So at around that time that you were mentioning, women became full-time students at the university. Mm-hmm. What effect did that have on the school?
Well, I think that it was a good thing. Once again, it was under Jesuit administration, and I think they were teaching order, decided that this was the right thing to do. And I sat on the committee that negotiated the beginnings of that. And I just think that their decision was right. It was a good thing to bring one into the institution. Bothers me a bit now when I go over there and around the main lobby and I'll hear some young girl giving a tour to a group of people talking about St. Mary's and illustrating the growth of the university by maybe pictures or whatnot that are around the place. And then one of them said one day, he said, you know, back in such and such a time when this was put in place, this was an institution for men only, I think. And I just recoiled. no sense of that at all. But at that time, not only at St. Mary's because they became co-ed, but the whole world experienced a tremendous, dramatic change with respect to discipline. And I don't think that the girls were responsible for changing that, but huge decrease in discipline in society at that time. Mm-hmm. I suppose girls were to some extent the recipients of that. But, my general reaction was that it was a good decision to go co-ed.
Did you have many female students in your classes in those early years?
No. Not in the early years. They came on gradually, but later on, I've had years when over 50% have been girls. Nowadays, it's dropped down below that again, so it's less than 50%. But the level of participation of girls today is much higher. They're much more relaxed in dealing with professors and dealing with men. Sometimes a little bit too aggressive. But, that's part of the social change in the world. And I sometimes ask myself, what did I do? And I voted for opening the university up to the girls when I experience this over aggressiveness, which I suppose is a form of defensiveness, because most girls don't feel that way, but some can be very aggressive. They're very aggressive with respect to marks and grades, because that holds the door to something else. But that's fundamentally not right, as far as I'm concerned. They should be more interested in understanding, rather than bottom line, grades, marks, this sort of thing. I've found that the girls today are more so than the men, aggressive in that respect. They're very determined to get these grades at all costs, you know. Not at all costs, but that's one of the reasons I decided I didn't want any further teaching. I could have applied for another contract, but my experience in the last couple of years was negative in that regard. I think I succeeded in turning the whole class around attitudinally, but it was a trying thing, it was a hard thing to do. And so I said, oh, my time has come, it's for another generation to do this.
So around that same time as well, the Jesuits gave over administrative control.
Yes, they gave over administrative control about 1970-71. There was an interim president at that time. Mr. Edmund Morris was appointed interim president. And then he was followed by the first lay president, was Dr. Kerrigan. Dr. Kerrigan was followed by Dr. Rosen. Mm-hmm.
So what effect did that have on the school, do you think? Also, as well, what role has religion played in the university through the time that you've been here? Has that changed?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Because it played a very, very important role while the Jesuits were here. And after the Jesuits passed over the administration, it dropped dramatically. And that's another thing that perhaps couldn't have stopped it because it was a worldwide trend, but I regret it. And the lay people didn't attempt to maintain that that aspect or that dimension of university life to the same extent that the Jesuits did. So I think we'll have to look at that historically, maybe in a few more years yet, just to see what was behind it. I'm tending back in that direction now, actually, in the work that I've been doing with people from outside the university. And once again, trying to find the role of religion in the world. But, well, there was a big change, but as I say, you have to look at the changes in the whole world in that period. We talked about this in another place and another context in the spring. And one of the persons who was there held a very, very, very high position in Canadian life. Public life, and I made reference to the fact that, such and such all changed in 1970. And this person was a very thoughtful person and said, after thinking for a bit, there were about 70 people, I think we should have fought harder. 1970. So, as I say, this historically, you'll look back and assess that.
Okay. Now, also in the early 70s, St. Mary's became one of the first universities to unionize. What do you think led to that decision, and what effect do you think it had?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was all part of the social change. There were a group of people, young people, young faculty members, who reacted to discipline, did not want discipline, they did not want to be told by the administration or anybody else, really, what to do. They felt that they were the ones to decide. I can remember Dr. McCormick and Dr. Monahan, who seemed to feel strongly that way. they were professors, and I was a, I guess I'm not sure whether I was a dean at the time or whether I was just a professor. And we were discussing something about I forget the issue. Do you want to check that, Jim? Yeah, the comment was made, well, you certainly don't think that you're an employee here, do you? You are at the university. And I don't know, didn't agree with that at all. I came from a background where there was more discipline in life than that. And I said to myself, well, academic thinking and wanting to be liberal in my thoughts and so on, but yeah, I worked for St. Mary's. But they were, oh no, you don't think you're an employee. The professors are not employees of the university, they are at the university. Now, you can say that goes back to Harvard to Oxford and Cambridge and so on, but it was a kind of thinking that was throughout society. And so these people came in and they wanted to had a say, and they wanted with working conditions, salaries, and the whole, so they just organized. It wasn't my model, and I never joined. But because of the way it was set up, you had to pay anyway. You pay the money out of your salary each month, but I never considered myself a member, and I specifically told the administration when I left administration, back to faculty, I am not a member of the union. I didn't think that a union model is appropriate for university. But they accomplished some good things. And I still don't think that it's a model for university.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Talk a little bit about the student population over the time you've been here. We talked about it in terms of gender. How about age and ethnic origin? Have you noticed any changes in those areas over the time you've been here?
No, not a great deal. Well, age, yeah. There are many more mature students now than there were, more and more adults are deciding to come back. We don't see that many of them in the science faculty, because the times at which our courses are taught are not convenient. But we've had some. I can recall a couple of real fine people. One was a captain in the Navy, about to retire. And, you know, high profile, smart man. And I admired the way they maintained their dignity, but were friendly and on even keel with the students. They were just wonderful at it, you know. But there aren't that many, there haven't been that many in science faculty. You'll find a lot more than in the other faculties. So that question doesn't really hit us in science to any degree. So ethnic origin, not an awful lot, because even going back into the 50s, there was a sizable, on the basis of total numbers, students who were here from Hong Kong and from other provinces of Canada. That group four that I speak of, one was from the Caribbean, one was from Quebec, and two of them were from Halifax. And today, you got the statistic in the paper the other day, 85% are Nova Scotian. There may have been even a little, there could have been more Americans, for example, back here in those days, than there are now. Mm-hmm. So, but the ethnic origin part, you see small numbers of people here from international programs, but no large groups like there were from Hong Kong, the Chinese population. And the Chinese population still is, I think, pretty sizable on a relative basis here. You know? Mm-hmm. I see the odd one from Africa and whatnot, but nothing that would impress me one way or another in that regard.
Okay, those are about the areas that I wanted to cover, unless you can think of any other events or changes that stand out in your mind over the years you've been here?
No, as I say, I've been protective of myself in thinking about this. You've hit the major transitions. The move from arts and science to science, and then the consolidation of engineering and science in one faculty and the growth of that faculty. That was, from my point of view, that's one development which had a lot of impact because we were the ones that forced the issue on research, on qualifications. I was as popular as a skunk at a garden party because I insisted on PhDs. And I encouraged a lot of faculty who had master's degrees to either upgrade or move on. And I was not popular. Mathematics would not come into the science faculty until I left because I pushed that thing. So now they're in the science faculty. And many of the people with master's degrees did upgrade, and now they're happy and they're full-fledged professors. And so that was... one thing that we really had a big impact on. Mm-hmm. And the move of the Jesuits away from the administration was a significant move. But again, I would be tempted to say we lost a lot of class. However, again, we did experience a growth, and we'll only be able to look back in time to come and just assess it afterwards. And the development of coeducation, again, very significant decision on the part of the Jesuits. They set the stage for all these things. And St. Mary's has benefited a good deal for that. And I'm not worried about the number of female faculty that are here in terms of their numbers, whether they're less than 50% or not. I'm much more interested in the quality of input of the students. Jesus, I don't know what's wrong with me. Crazy. That's where I think, as far as female faculty are concerned, that'll come. Be patient, wait, but don't hammer that on the basis of rights. And God, I would fire people that did that. Still, I'd fire them. But you'll find that these telling the story. Buckminster Fuller. You ever hear of him? Well, ask around. Very creative man, architect, designer, futurist. 44, 45 honorary degrees, two of them from Harvard. I thought that was unusual until I heard that Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame has 108 honorary degrees. Another real strong leader. Yeah, don't knock John A. MacDonald, why not? Strong leaders have a big impact. Anyway, Buckminster Fuller and I met over in Israel, and it was at a time when I was experiencing all this unrest and so on and developing the faculty. And he had just finished talking to 700 to 800 international engineers, a big audience, about pollution and how the world was going to deal with this. Terrific address. started with the creation of the world out there, brought the whole thing right down to right here on Earth today. And then he told all these people in the audience, most of them were gray-haired, you have the knowledge now to solve 90% of the world's pollution problems. Your research programs are going to enable you to solve at least 6% more. And you're only left with about 4% that you can't get your hands on right now. But that'll come. But unfortunately, there's not a thing you can do about it. Because the nature of your training and your professional approach, you can't deal with the political dimension and the decision-making roles that are involved in the societal picture. The approach is to give that knowledge to the young people. He said, today you've got, some days I rattle it off and some days my mind doesn't give me. They are interested, they're informed, and they're intelligent. And somebody else later told me there's another one starting with an I. He said, you give them those answers and they're going to solve the problem. And then coffee break, or not coffee break, on the way back from Haifa, where we were, down to Tel Aviv, along the shore of the Mediterranean, we stopped and had one of those. First time I ever had something like that, and a bottle of beer, right by the Mediterranean, beautiful, warm day under a tree there. All these guys trying to get a hold of Buckminster Fuller, and I ended up right beside him, and a great one-on-one chat. And I said, you know, you've got a great deal of confidence in the young people. I said, I'm a young dean of science, and I have a vision that I'm trying to direct the program, and I'm having a heck of a time trying to direct some of these young professors. Oh, he threw up his hand. He said, don't you pay any attention to young professors. They've all got axes to grind. You go to the young students. They're the ones that are going to do the job for you. So everybody was after me, and I sort of turned a little bit, put my head down, and I said, well, I guess I must be patient. And he spun around, left the people he was going to meet, came back, he said, my dear young man, this is the most traumatic period in human history. You must be patient. So, that's why my cup.
Is that good?